Welcome to the Parents Place podcast with Hillary and Jen.
Welcome to the Parents Place podcast. We have a special guest with us today that we are excited to introduce you to. And we have Rachel here with us, and she is a dietitian, and I love that she has given her time to be able to speak with us on her expertise in this field. So, Rachel, before we dive into the topic, just tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, maybe how you came to the career that you have.
Yeah. I'm Rachel Rood, and I'm a registered dietitian. I got my bachelor's degree in nutrition and dietetics in 92, so a few years ago, and then my master's in 94. And I kind of came to be to dietitian because I was interested in healthcare, but I'm not so much into like body fluids and things like that. So it's like healthcare, but without the grossness. Since I finished my degree, I've kind of done a little bit of everything. My first job was WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children program. So that gave me a really great introduction to infant and child nutrition and that feeding relationship between parents and children. Did a little bit of clinical in a hospital, and then for a lot of years I just taught the undergraduate nutrition course for Utah State University and also for the Community College of Vermont. And then about 12 years ago I was looking for a little more work and took a leap of faith and took a job with the residential eating disorder treatment program and ended up really loving that and feeling like that was kind of my niche and calling. And then in 2018 I started a private practice, and now I'm exclusively in private practice, primarily seeing people with eating disorders, disordered eating, some picky eating with children, a wide variety. But my overall goal is to help people have a healthy relationship with food rather than preach strict nutrition do's and don'ts.
Okay, I'm excited to ask you all the things about that. So before we do though, if there is an individual that is thinking, I would love to learn a little bit more about this, to connect with Rachel, tell us about the services that you offer, and if these are virtual, if these are in person, if they can go outside of Utah. So what are some of the ways that they can access these resources?
Yeah, so with my private practice, I have a website. The name of my practice is Positive Change Nutrition. You can just Google that. I do take insurance, most major insurances. So yeah, you're welcome to look it up and schedule an appointment. I do in-person and virtual appointments. I'm licensed in Idaho and Utah, and then it kind of varies by state to state whether they require dietitian licensure or not. So I kind of have clients randomly scattered across the country, but mostly Utah. So,
okay. Yeah. Perfect. I love it. So Positive Change Nutrition.
Yes.
Is what you mentioned. Okay, perfect. We will make sure we include that website in our show notes so that our listeners have access to that. But we'll definitely take a look. So this idea of developing a healthy relationship with food.
Yes.
I love this because we've talked before in other episodes of the podcast how you look at society and you look at our culture with food and you look at all of our, you know, fad diets and foods that are good and then foods that are bad and then foods that are good once again. And
right.
It can be such a confusing aspect of our life to know what should and shouldn't I be eating. And so how does one go about developing this healthy relationship with food?
Yes. Well, my favorite approach is called intuitive eating, and it's a book, and there's also a workbook, and it's my Bible. So it's, if you want to know, go ahead and read that. And then with children, Ellen Satter wrote a book called Feeding with Love and Good Sense and talks about the feeding relationship between parents and children. So she's a great resource also. But I think I think we tend to have this love-hate relationship with food. and instead thinking of food as a way to fuel your body and take care of your body and nourish your body rather than focus on, you know, getting hyper-focused on do's and don'ts. I really think good nutrition boils down to balance, variety, and moderation, right? So anytime you're looking at fad diets or new nutrition information, ask yourself, does that help me be balanced and have variety and moderation? And if the answer is no, then it's probably not the right thing for you. So I think kind of bringing down that anxiety too of, am I eating the right things or wrong things, and just being more flexible with it and wanting to have a healthy base, right? But not getting too caught up in good foods, bad foods, healthy food, junk food. Yeah.
That's such a mindset change, I think, for so many people. That essentially, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, I can eat it, all of the things out there, right?
Yes.
But it just, I'm not going to consume 5 bags of chips a day. But
right.
If I want a few chips on my plate, then that's fine, because it goes back to that balance and moderation.
Exactly.
So I love that, that it opens up the window to say, all food, essentially, is good food, but I just need to be smarter about making those choices.
Yeah, it's the pattern of how you eat it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if all you ever eat is donuts, that's not healthy. But if all you ever eat is broccoli, that's also not healthy, right? So, the idea with intuitive eating, one of the principles, there's 10 principles, and the last one is gentle nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of once you've made peace with food and allowed yourself to eat the foods that you like and enjoy, paying attention to, okay, what pattern of eating feels good and supports my health, right? And if I eat donuts all day, I don't feel good. But also if I eat broccoli all day, I don't feel so good. So paying attention to, like, I can have any food I want, but what pattern of eating feels good? And usually it's when you're having variety and balance and moderation, it feels good to feed yourself in that way.
So I'm not going to name names.
Okay.
About any particular diets out there, right? But what you're saying is these diets that totally eliminate certain food groups aren't the best for us.
No, they are not.
Okay.
And the bottom line of why they're not is they're not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, we can't eliminate entire food groups on a long-term basis. Now, there are people who have health situations that, you know, whether it's a food allergy or things like that, that they may have to eliminate certain types of foods or ingredients or things like that. And absolutely, people should follow that because that's honoring your health. But otherwise, like, it just doesn't make sense to completely cut out whole food groups. Plus, you're lacking variety and not getting all of the nutrients that you need.
I was one of those stupid people that
I don't know if stupid is the right word.
I was stupid. Not everyone else, just me. But it really messed with my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my husband finally said, because we were doing it together, and he finally said, you are not happy. And I said, I haven't been happy for 4 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I'm spiraling.
Happiness game. It was when.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had all of the adverse effects of the rash and the sickness that came with it. And all of the eliminating everything. I'm like, I can't have an apple. I can't have strawberries.
Right.
I can't
doesn't make sense,
right? I can't have a banana. I love bananas.
Well, these things that we have been taught since we were little are good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fruits and vegetables are good. And so now as an adult, though, we're being told the opposite message that, no, never mind.
Mm-hmm.
Take that back.
Yeah.
Right.
You can't eat fruit at all.
I think cried when I had to get rid of oatmeal. Called my brother and I'm like, do I have to get rid of oatmeal? He's like, yes. And I'm like, okay.
But I don't want to.
Into the trash it goes.
That's a perfect example of why those extreme diets aren't helpful. Yeah.
Nope.
But in your defense, it's hard not to feed into that message.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you see other people around you that are losing weight quickly, and claiming that this is the new lifestyle that we want to mm-hmm. live, and you see ads and billboards and all sorts of success stories out there, mm-hmm. it's hard not to say,
right.
Well, I want what they have.
Yeah, yeah. It's a brother in your ear saying, you should try this.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, because I am, you know, older, I've seen that cycle happen over and over and over and over again, right? With the new fad diet that everybody tries and loses weight, and then they regain the weight. So then there's a new diet that is repackaged in a different shiny bow that, no, this is the one.
Yeah.
This is the magic one that will solve all the problems.
So, along with having this balance, variety, and moderation, do we need to include, because I know another very big push in the health world, or not necessarily in the health world, let's just say, in the social media world, is also counting calories and, you know, like tracking the amounts of foods we're eating. Like, should we avoid doing that as well too? Or do we, is there good to doing that?
I think mostly no.
Okay.
It's not that helpful. I think what I often see is people become hyper-focused on it. And whether or not you meet that calorie goal determines whether you have a good day or a bad day. Right? So if you meet it, yes, I was good. I was good today. And it values foods solely based on calories. But there are calorie-dense foods that have really good nutrition, but probably should be consumed moderately, right? So I think it just puts too much of a focus on that. I think it's okay to have caloric awareness. Like, I think sometimes people are really surprised how much calories are in certain foods and really had no idea. But if there is a calorie dense food that you just really love and enjoy, it's okay to enjoy it sometimes.
Okay.
Did that answer that question?
Definitely.
Okay.
I have never been one that, I don't know, I, just the idea of meticulously tracking everything that goes in my mouth, I'm like, that is,
exhausting.
That would consume my life.
It's tedious.
And so when people encourage that, I'm like, I don't even know where to begin.
Tried an app, and it was still overwhelming.
Yes.
Well, and the issue with the app, and I won't name names of apps, but they present it as if it's this simple formula, right? It says, you put in your height and weight, and it says if you eat this many calories and expend this many calories, it equals this weight loss. Unfortunately, our bodies don't know that formula, and so people will follow that and not get X amount of weight loss, and it gets really frustrating. And then it leads people into maybe more disordered behaviors, or throw it all out the window and disregard my health response. So I think that's another piece that gets really discouraging when people are doing that tracking.
And it makes complete sense. I'm glad that you brought up, Jen, this idea that when you were using that diet, that it did hurt your mental health. Because like you mentioned, Rachel, you know, my happiness depends on, did I make it under the mark that I was supposed to make it? And if I didn't, then that day is a fail. And you can see how, if that occurs day after day after day, how that's going to play a toll.
Right.
And to have a man dropping,
yes.
And I'm like,
yes.
It was just,
yes.
Yeah, it was not good.
So let's say that you have a client that comes in and, you know, you explain this process of intuitive eating, finding that balance, that variety and moderation, and their goal is to find that in their life, but they do also want to potentially get to a healthier weight.
Right.
So how do you incorporate that, but keeping in mind that there may be a few pounds that I do want to drop?
Right. I really try to encourage people trying the intuitive eating process. And there's no guarantee with the intuitive eating process. Ideally, when we're listening to our bodies and eating in a way that's moderate and flexible and moving our bodies in a way that's moderate and flexible, our body's going to gravitate to kind of our internal genetic set point. a lot of times I think we are unhappy with where our body says it's happy. And we want to change that. And I think anytime you have to engage in extreme food behaviors or extreme exercise behaviors to try to override where your body wants to be, then it's not a healthy weight for you. And I've also found that people's acceptance of their bodies improve as they go down that intuitive eating journey. Because when you're no longer at war with your body and wanting to take care of it and nourish it in a way that feels good, you feel better about your body, even if maybe it doesn't change. But then some people do lose weight, but it's not as whenever weight loss is the top priority, you can't truly be an intuitive eater.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And it makes sense, right? That my goal should be to fuel my body, to give it the energy that it needs to participate in the activities that I want to do. And that, in essence, doesn't have anything to do with weight loss. It has to do with keeping my body in a healthy state of mind.
Yes.
Regardless of what that weight is on the scale. So,
yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's a mindset shift.
Yeah. Yeah. But it can be done.
It can be done.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think just thinking of this, it also puts space in there for someone who may have trauma, and this is their way of coping with that trauma. But then saying, okay, I have this, but how can I, you know, intuitively eat and still help me with this trauma thing, but in a better way? And I don't know. I always just heard people who have trauma, that's one way that they have masked themselves to protect themselves.
Absolutely.
And so I think it's twofold. You have to handle that stuff and that stuff.
Yes.
But if we can at least have that good relationship, then you probably can work on the other in a better way.
And I do provide people with some structure for their eating, right? Because people might not have good hunger and fullness cues if they've, you know, used food in a disordered way for a really long time. Trying to completely rely on body cues often doesn't go well. So when I'm first working with people, I'll talk about combining intentional and intuitive eating. So the intentional is, I'm going to feed my body consistently. I'm going to provide a variety of nutrients, and then try to listen and pay attention to hunger and fullness within that structure. So I do start people with some structure, because if they do have a trauma history that, you know, impacts how they eat or don't have good hunger and fullness cues, you know, when I see a lot of people with ADHD and they may be on medications that impact their appetite. So there are situations when people can't really rely on body cues, but there's 10 intuitive eating principles, and there's only two about hunger and fullness, and the rest you can apply even if you need to use some structured eating a little bit more than maybe someone else does.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm thinking we all need an ally like you on our side at all times.
Thank you.
And so my question is, this mindset that we have, the mindset that you've helped us to develop today, does the medical field, so I'm thinking, like, if I go out to my doctor and I'm a little bit overweight, does he recognize this same mindset? Are we on the same page, or is there still some work to be done in that aspect?
The short answer is there's work to be done
okay.
in that aspect. But I think there are more and more healthcare providers that are more weight inclusive.
Okay.
And look at the person and their issues rather than necessarily basing completely on weight. I think what's frustrating is you can have someone that's maybe at a higher weight come in for a problem, and they're given the advice to lose weight, and someone who's at a quote-unquote normal weight go in for the same problem, and they're provided with different recommendations in healthcare. And so I think that is unfortunately still a huge bias in our health, mainstream healthcare industry about the relationship between weight and health. And there's a lot of good research that shows that it's not as direct of a relationship as we've been taught and told and led to believe. It's more about health behaviors than actual numbers on a scale.
Yeah. We'll get there, yes. Right? We'll cross our fingers.
Hopefully.
It's going to take good people like you to help, I think, make that awareness happen across the board. But I'm glad that, many are starting to see that.
Yeah.
See that it's not just about the scale. So. Yeah.
I went into a doctor and I sat down. I said, I don't want to hear anything about my weight. Do not say anything about it. I know I need to lose it, so don't say anything. But it was with back issues, and my mom's had back issues, and her mom has had back issues, and so there's a whole genetic arthritis in the back and the spine, and so he's like, okay.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, and I said, no, you're going to go there, and he said, well, I was, and he said, let's get an MRI first, and I'm like, okay, and there it is, there's that wonderful little thing called arthritis that is in my lower back and in lots of other places now too. Who thought, being as old as I am, I would be having arthritis problems already?
And I think it's okay to set that boundary, right? If you're someone who has gone into medical providers and over again been lectured about your weight when you're there for a sinus infection, right? That's not related at all. I think you can set that boundary of like, I'm not here to talk about my weight. You also don't have to be weighed. You can, I will just say no thank you.
Interesting. And I never thought this to do like that.
Glorious information.
But you think about like the ability to advocate on behalf of yourself and to be able to say,
it's out in the freaking hall.
Not this time.
Well, and the only time they actually need to know your weight is if you're having surgery so they can dose your anesthesia. Let them weigh you then.
But there are times, you're right, that it's probably an unnecessary component to
It's not trauma informed either.
Right.
Out in the hallway where everyone walking by.
Well, I'm just thinking of an experience. So through you know, that stage of my life where I was having my kids, I had a few different doctors who delivered my children. And there was one doctor that, and I understand that as part of your pregnancy, they do want to track to an extent, you know, how much gain you've had and how that's important. But I remember I had one particular doctor that, you know, you'd step on the scale per usual, and when he would come in for the appointment, that was usually the very first thing he'd start with, is he'd say, well, we've gained this many pounds since our last visit, and that was like, welcome to the doctor's office. Do you want to see how much bigger you are?
Yeah.
And every time I'm like, let's ease into this. Give me some other information as to, hey, how are you feeling? Mm-hmm. You know, what have you been up to? You know, even starting out with, like, how's the eating going? You know, have you been able to keep food in? I know that oftentimes people are ill, so they can't do that. Have you been able to stay active? What does that look like for you? But that was always one of the very first things that he reported on. And I compare that to one of my other doctors who, they still did the weight check.
Yeah.
But he never mentioned anything about, here's how much you've gained or lost.
Right.
You know, they made notes. And I'm sure that if there were to be a problem, they would have addressed it with me. But it didn't need to be vocalized.
Right.
It wasn't the highlight of being there.
And if you were gaining consistently, then it's a non-issue.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it is important to check it during pregnancy. I agree with that, right? Because if there's not enough weight gain, it could be indicative of a problem. And too much weight gain can also be indicative of a problem, right? Like the preeclampsia, you can see some rapid weight gain. But, outside of that, it's kind of a non-issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to compare those differences and compare how I felt leaving those doctor visits every time.
Yes.
Because there was a very big difference between feeling defeated about, I shouldn't be eating as much because obviously that's too much, versus I'm doing great.
Yeah.
If he would let me know otherwise.
Right.
But I'm doing great.
Yeah. So interesting how their focus shifted your experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm thinking all of this in children.
Yes.
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 How can you get children to understand that nice balance and moderation?
Mm-hmm. One of the best things we can do as parents is model that, right? So I think if, as a parent, if you're looking at your own food behaviors and maybe you're have a lot of kind of yo-yo dieting or some disordered eating, like, addressing your own food issues is so important, because I think a lot of times we think kids don't notice, but they notice, mm-hmm. you know, and I work with so many people who can identify, well, my mom did this, my dad said mm-hmm. this, right? And so I think modeling that variety, and also with the way we talk about our bodies, right? Mm-hmm. So the way we talk about our own bodies, we're not necessarily directing it at our children, but if we're talking negatively about our bodies and our children are looking at us, then they internalize those messages, right? Of like, mm-hmm. well, if my mom looks like that and she's unhappy, then I shouldn't mm-hmm. look like this, or I need to change things so I don't have that happen. Mm-hmm. So if we can talk positively about our own bodies, about other people's bodies, about our children's bodies, it's so important, because people just hold on to that. Like little things that parents say that is negative about their bodies, they hold mm-hmm. on to it and they remember it for so long. So, you know, making comments about like, you're doing a great job fueling your body today mm. to do the fun things that you want to do, you know, and it's okay to let them know like, hey, that food does really good things for you and is healthy for you and it's good. But then when we make comments about like, oh, that's junk food and that's bad for you and you shouldn't be eating it, or if we don't allow children to have those foods, mm-hmm. then you'll find a lot of kids will engage in like sneaking behavior and develop shame around liking and wanting those foods, where if they're offered and allowed, then it's normalized that these foods are okay to have sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Makes me think of someone who would bring her kids into work and they would go around the office seeing who had the candy, because they were not allowed candy at home.
And sometimes kids are just going to do that anyway, right?
She would always say, you can ask Santa for that. You can ask Santa for that. I'm like,
how sad that they get candy once a year.
Yeah.
So they would go around looking yeah. for where it was.
Not that I am the star when it comes to this by any means, because I have the opposite situation in our house, that we don't have treats aplenty, but we tend to have some treats around the house. But it's always funny to me because my kids will go trick-or-treating or mm-hmm. they'll get some treats for different holidays, and those treats will sit in our yeah. pantry for weeks. Mm-hmm. And I get a little frustrated sometimes, and I turn to my husband and I'm like, why are we doing this? And I think for them it's like, it's the appeal of let's go trick-or-treating because mm-hmm. that's really fun and that's a social engaging activity. But when it comes down to eating the candy, usually it just sits.
But if they weren't ever allowed to have yes. it, then those
then,
are the kids yeah. who are just going to eat it as quickly as they can and make themselves sick.
Yeah. So, good. I'm doing yeah. something right.
Yes.
It's there for the opportunity in moderation.
Right.
And I think it's a great lesson that they learn. It's here. You have some, but we're going to eat it in mm-hmm. certain periods of time mm-hmm. or in amounts or whatnot.
What I love about Ellen Satter, she talks about the feeding relationship between parents and children. And her philosophy is parents are responsible for when and what is provided, mm-hmm. right? So especially with young kids, we want to have consistent eating time so they know when to expect to eat, right? And it's sometimes those times are going to get thrown off. That's normal. Mm-hmm. But if the kids have like no idea what time they're going to be fed dinner, then it can be upsetting and, you know, it's hard for them when they don't have structure. So the parents provide that structure when they're going to eat and what is being offered. So that's where parents have that opportunity to offer a variety. Mm-hmm. But then the kids are responsible for how much and whether.
Mm-hmm.
So we offer that variety. But, you know, I can't tell you how many adults mm. I have that were very picky eaters, had textural issues, mm-hmm. like maybe some neurodivergence that contributed to those textural issues, that they were forced to eat foods that were really aversive to them, mm-hmm. or forced to sit at a table for hours until they ate something.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
Because that was something, I'm like, is that even good to have kids sit there?
No.
Because I remember sitting there many times.
Or you have to have these three bites before you can get off the table sort of thing.
And it's okay to encourage no thank you bite, especially if it's something that they haven't tried before, because you'll put it in front of a kid and they'll be like, ew, yuck, what is this? And you're like, why did I even try? Right? But then it's like, you know, I'd like you to take one no thank you bite, and if you don't want any more of it after that, that's okay. She also recommends, though, that when you are providing a new food at a meal, make sure there's at least something familiar at the meal that you know that children are like, right? So serve some rolls and some milk. So if all they eat is the roll and milk, they're getting nutrition and they're not going to starve to death, and it's not the end of the world, right? And then have structured snacks where you provide a variety, and you can have the fun foods, which I very much prefer that term to junk foods. They can, you know, have fun foods as part of their snacks or as part of dinner, and they don't have to finish their meal to get dessert, because when we're forcing children to clean their plates, we're teaching them to not be intuitive eaters, right? And I think there are cues that parents can give children of, like, because sometimes kids just want to get down and go and play, and you know that they haven't eaten very much, right?
It's not necessarily about the food either, but it's maybe the distraction.
So you can help them check in and be like, well, tell me, does your tummy feel full? Right? Tell me what your tummy's telling you. And if it's like, oh, it's full, and it's, I think it's okay to have a rule of, like, you can sit at the table with the family during mealtime. You don't have to eat, don't have to clear your plate, but we're going to sit here as a family. And then at that point, they'll probably choose to eat more since they can't get down anyway. But so providing that structure at mealtime, try to limit distractions, but forcing kids to eat is counterintuitive and it takes away from their ability to listen to their bodies.
Making these notes because I'm like, this is so good. I love that the adults are in charge of the when and the what is provided, and the kids are in charge of how much and whether. I think that's a very big shift for parents and parenting. So I think that's a powerful reminder for us. Because we are very accustomed to finish your plate, or you have to take five bites before you can get down. So
it was interesting. I had seen it in play at friend's house, and having a bowl of fruit on the table, but then the kids could go into the pantry, and the kids would always come and ask, can I have another snack between lunch and dinner? And she would say, okay, there's bananas and apples and oranges on the table. You had whatever fun food you had a little bit earlier, so let's choose one of these, and then maybe later we can choose another fun food. But it was, and the girls were like, okay, and so they go and pick it, and they were just fine. But I think it's just that consistency of being in that structure of, this is what it's going to look like, and just ask me and I'll let you know.
And not vilifying the fun foods, right? But it's like, well, you've already had that. Let's have some variety and something different. You can choose from the fruit or things like that. Instead of be like, well, you've had enough sweets for today.
And it got to the point where the girls were just saying, can I have an apple? I'm sure you can have an apple.
It's when you've won in life. When you have a child that asks for an apple.
You know, some kids just don't like it, and that's okay. Some kids just aren't going to like the vegetables. And it's not a failure as a parent.
But I think, you know, it goes back to the idea is, if we're really good at offering this balance and variety, these kids, whether they choose not to eat the broccoli at that sitting, if that's something that they see on their plate on a regular basis, I think eventually they will try it. And so having that variety where you're probably always going to see some type of vegetable on that plate, and there may be days where maybe you choose not to eat that, but it's always going to be there as an option. I think they're more likely, if that's, like you said, if it's a consistent thing that they're being offered.
For sure.
So here's my problem.
Okay.
And I don't know if it is a me thing, but I do think it might actually be a Utah thing as well, too. That food is a way for us to celebrate. And so I'm thinking, you know, my kid gets a good grade, let's go out to get ice cream. We celebrate the last day of school, let's go get a treat. And so for me, you know, like, I use treats as like an opportunity to celebrate, to congratulate. And I think I've gone too far on this, on the opposing side. But it's hard because I think that's what we do as a society. Mm-hmm. We've done something great. We deserve X, Y, and Z. And usually that is some type of a fun food. So is that okay?
It is okay. It is okay. You know, and I think one of the things that I love about intuitive eating, one of the principles, and they actually changed it a little bit, which I love the change that they made, because it used to be cope with your emotions without food. Mm-hmm. And then in the most recent edition, they changed it to cope with your emotions with kindness. Mm-hmm. And so I think trying to remove emotional attachments from food doesn't mm-hmm. make sense, mm-hmm. right? And I can think of particular meals or foods that have an emotional attachment for me, right? Like anytime I have like 3 bean salad, I think of my grandma because we would have that at Thanksgiving and I loved it, right? So it's okay to have those emotional attachments. I think what we want to be cautious with is associating food with reward or punishment. Mm. So a celebration, absolutely, it's fine to celebrate with food and a treat and going out and going to a favorite restaurant or whatever mm-hmm. it is. But I think being cautious that we're not often using food as a reward and absolutely not withholding food as a punishment.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
We love our treats.
It's fun.
It is, but I can definitely see that there is a lot of emotion attached to that. And mm-hmm. it's hard to pull that apart. And so I appreciate you say that you don't necessarily have to, right?
Right. Yeah. If, however, you are using food for any emotion mm-hmm. that ever happens, mm-hmm. then it's time to look at that and think, okay, do I need other ways to deal with my emotions besides food, right? If I'm overly relying on food and maybe even, you know, large amounts of food to soothe my emotions, then that's a problem. But if it's like, I've had a really crappy long day at work and I'm going to enjoy a bowl of ice cream, I am.
I get that.
And it helps, right? But if ice cream is my answer to if I'm happy or sad or bored or tired, right? And if it's a half a gallon of ice cream, then that's something to look at.
True.
It's something to look at.
Since you have spent so much of your career working with individuals with eating disorders, mm-hmm. I'm just thinking as a parent, maybe we have maybe there's someone out there that has a child that we're fearful that maybe it is going down mm-hmm. that road. How do we know when we've reached that point where they may need some additional help outside of what we can offer in our house?
Yeah. So I honestly think if you are seeing red flags, warning signs to you that your child may be engaging in some disordered eating, I think as parents, a lot of times we will think, oh, it's just a phase. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's mm-hmm. fine. You know, all kids do this. I really think being, what's the word I'm looking for? Like progressive, mm-hmm. like what?
Proactive.
Yeah. Thank you. I knew it started with a P.
Progressive is good too.
Yes. Being proactive and seeking some help. And ideally an eating disorder informed medical provider, because again, sometimes kids will go to a doctor and maybe they've lost some weight and the doctor congratulates them on their weight loss mm-hmm. because they've lowered their BMI mm-hmm. rather than, okay, well, what behaviors led to this weight loss, right? But I think ideally having them see a therapist that has some eating disorder experience, a dietitian mm-hmm. that has eating disorder experience, and asking for support of how you can best support your child. Mm-hmm. And every kid's different, right? Like as far as how they react to parental involvement and interactions around food. So I do think it's helpful to be proactive and nip it in the bud rather than let it get to the point that it's like, okay, hey, this is really a problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at those first initial signs.
Yeah.
Pay particular attention and maybe start seeking out that help.
Yes.
Okay.
And most eating disorders start with kids saying, oh, I just want to be a little healthier. Cutting out sugar seems to be the number one starting place of, I'm going to cut out sugar for the summer, right? And then when you see it start to, then portions get smaller, or they're cutting more out, or things like that, that you're like, okay.
You tend to see a typical age from when that happens?
It's really variable. I think a lot of times for girls, puberty is a huge trigger.
Okay.
And middle school just sucks anyway.
Yes,
you know
it
what
does.
I mean?
Yes. So then you just gotta add more.
Right. So I think kind of around that prepubescent age is not uncommon for girls to start to see, especially at least body image issues, even if it's not showing up as food behaviors yet. And then I see a lot of through high school, and then in college, freshman year seems to be a high risk time also. Yeah. And then I haven't seen as much pattern in males, but I do work with males, and also, you know, LGBTQ population and non-binary kids can have kind of their own issues around food and body image that's kind of unique to those populations also.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I have loved everything that you have shared today.
Oh, good.
This has been so fantastic, and I'm just kind of taking it in and making kind of mental notes of what I can do on a day-to-day basis with my own children and for myself on how to make some of these changes. So as we kind of wrap up our time together, are there any other final tips that you would want our listeners to hear? Like maybe major takeaways that you would share?
I think just relax.
I like that. We'll do that.
One of the textbooks that I used years ago, and I wish I could remember which one it was or where it came from, but early on in the book it says that most people tend to either under or overthink nutrition and health, that there's not a lot of people who are in the middle, right? Like people either don't think about it or care about it at all, or people are hyper focused and overly worried and attentive to it. So kind of trying to find that happy medium, right? Like I want to be healthy, I want to provide a good variety, I want to move my body, I want to take care of myself, but being crazy about it doesn't help me or my family or my relationships. So just relax.
Okay. I'll take that advice today. That's perfect. But it's so true.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm just thinking, yes, we either have those that are like, I'm going to do what I want. Doesn't matter. But then you also have those that are meticulous and tracking and processing every little thing that is in their mouth. And I don't want to live either way.
Right.
I want to live that balanced life where I'm aware of what I'm eating, but I can embrace each and every type of food.
Right.
But I also can stay active as well in that process of doing so. I love that.
Yes.
Love that. Okay. You heard it. We're relaxing. We're relaxing this
Be
weekend.
Be nice.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing your expertise with us. We really appreciate it. I've learned a lot. Hillary has learned a lot, and hopefully our listeners have as well. We want to thank you for coming and listening today, and we remind you to be kind and patient with yourselves, and we will see you back here next week. Thank you for listening to the Parents Place podcast. If you would like to reach us, you can at parents@thefamilyplaceutah.org, or you can reach Jen on Facebook, jendaly-thefamilyplace. Please check out our show notes for any additional information. Our website is thefamilyplaceutah.org if you're interested in any of our upcoming virtual classes. We'd love to see you there.